Hello, and welcome to the Movie Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be spotlighting a movie that we think you'll find interesting. This episode, I'm joined by my sister, and we're going to have a spoiler-filled discussion on Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom from 2023. This is one of the later ones of that era of DC films. I forget if it was the last one or not. There are two others that take place before this that we haven't watched, but this didn't connect to the rest of the DC universe in any meaningful way. I think Galaxy Broadcasting System news was the only, even tangential thing. I was surprised how much this was not just a sequel, but it felt like in some ways a continuation of the first film.
Yeah.
With the Black Manta saga, everything with Orm, the Ocean Master and stuff. And that movie came out 5 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And granted, it took us a while to get to this one, but there were a couple of things where I'm like, wait a sec, what's going on here? And I had totally forgotten Black Manta was in the first film.
Oh, so had I. Yeah.
So when we start this film and we've got Arthur Jr., I'm like, yeah, I know who the villain's going to be. Because one of the pivotal storylines, I want to say in late 60s, early 70s, back when Aquaman had an ongoing title, was Black Manta fighting Aquaman. And the decisive moment was around Arthur Jr.
Okay.
So there are parts of this story that thematically stem from that. There are parts where they definitely departed from that. And I can tell you that because Arthur Jr. survives here. He did not in the comics.
Oh, that defies the laws of the Hollywood happy ending that moviegoers want.
Comics didn't have that all the time.
No, but I'm going to say moviegoers want, not DC movies present. Because how many DC movies have ended with funerals and deaths?
Or started and ended with funerals. Yeah. So I expected the kid to survive. Again, law of happy endings with movies and stuff. It would have been very unsatisfying for the audience, myself included, if this effective newborn is slaughtered in the film. So they handled that gracefully. Overall, I liked the film. I'm not going to say I loved it.
I get that.
And part of that is when we've got Patrick Wilson there as Ocean Master, I think you could take a couple of stills from this where you've got the full shot of him in kind of the, I don't say aqua suit, but you know what I mean, where it's got, you know how they've got the A-shaped thing on everybody's belts? With that visible, plaster on top of it, Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom, and you could travel back to the 80s, the 90s, show people that and say, wouldn't this make a great film? And they're like, yeah, that guy's great for Aquaman.
Yeah.
And then have to say, yeah, but he's not Aquaman. He's the villain.
He got put on a redemption arc.
Yes, and did the redemption fairly well this time. So I appreciated that. I like a lot of the work Jason Momoa has done. I would not have cast him as Aquaman. And he's going to be in an upcoming DC film under the new regime as a different character.
Oh, interesting.
He's going to play Lobo, I think, in Supergirl, which is a much better fit, I think. I think it's also a character he wants to play, and there are aspects of his portrayal here where he's kind of almost in that berserker mode where it's essentially Lobo.
It's funny because he's Aquaman, but he seems to do a lot of, it's not fair to call it karate style fighting, but fighting that doesn't feel like it has any kind of graceful or water-based, if you will, moves to it. If that makes sense.
Yes. I think a fighting style that originated deep undersea would almost be more Tai Chi-like, just because you're moving in a medium that provides more resistance. It's going to be more slower, literally more fluid.
Yeah.
And the fight scenes here were interesting, were fun, but just like what little I recall of the first film, have almost that standard DC video game quality to them in all the not so right ways.
The fight scene that I guess was in Devil's Deep.
Devil's Island, I thought it was. Whichever.
Yeah, and it seemed to be kind of inside a volcano that went down into the water. So we've got where a submarine has come up inside the bottom of, I guess, an old volcano,
it can't be
whatever.
The bottom of a volcano, because the bottom of a volcano was lava.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Exactly. It defied logic. But what got me about that fight scene was the number of times I wanted to scream at the screen or at the characters, gosh, if only you'd fallen 2 feet over, you'd have landed in the water, you'd have gotten pumped up with energy from being in the water.
Yeah.
And I mean, they never even looked at the water like, gosh, if only I could reach it.
I would have played it a little differently along those lines when they had mentioned that there was something that was kind of shielding the thermal aspect or whatever. When things start breaking, the fighting is going on for a bit, I would have the temperature in there start to really heat up, and you'd start to see some steam.
Yeah.
And they may need to go cool off or something. There are ways they could have played that. Of course, the flip side is later in the film, the main action piece at the end is basically, it felt like in a frozen wasteland.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they covered the temperature extremes here because they were also in a desert at one point.
Yeah, well, in the frozen wasteland seemed to be, what, Antarctica, the Arctic Circle, something like that.
It's where that Seventh Kingdom was, and it was frozen over.
Yeah.
So, it worked. It made the scenes visually look different. To, again, have one in a desert, one in a volcano, one in a frozen wasteland. The amount of special effects, computer graphics needed for this film was staggering.
The environments looked different, but I'm going to say they were painted different, if you will.
They looked different, they didn't feel different.
Yeah, because they all had that 20-story high cliffside feeling.
Yep.
The mysterious bridge across nowhere. So many common themes. And even if we had just had a comment at one point of, no matter where you go in the Seven Kingdoms, Atlanteans build the same way.
Yeah, there was a strong architectural style amongst them. That would have been funny. I think a lot of production companies would have done better with each of the Seven Kingdoms having a very different visual feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a few things here when we get to Atlantis early in the movie, and there's the equivalent of the freeway system.
Yep.
And a few things like that that I'm going to say felt out of place, but felt odd to have.
Yeah. The speed made no sense, because I could have sworn they said they were going 600 knots.
Yeah, you should have been so far out of the city so fast.
Yeah.
I took it as people in the production company, possibly even James Wan himself, are so used to the Fast and the Furious and those kinds of movies that's the only way they could relate to an underwater one is to put those sorts of things in there.
And given the look of what clearly seemed intended to be a freeway system, if they had actually had the people who were chasing them as they approached it, calling out to one another, oh my god, we don't want to get swept up in that. Can't they see the barricades that say that that's the rip current or whatever? So it's one of those out-of-control currents that kind of, once you're in it, you don't know where you're going to end up.
It being almost a moving sidewalk equivalent, if you will, for cars, in terms of you put the car in there and then you can almost power down. It just takes you the rest of the way.
Mm-hmm.
There were so many things, though, that they did for the sake of it looks cool.
Mm-hmm.
The octopod vessels.
Yes.
The hammerhead shark design for the sub.
What was happening on the island with the volcano the sub came up in? Like, in the course of 5 or 6 months of pollution, suddenly butterflies are the size of human beings.
They mentioned radiation.
Okay.
And that somehow it had caused them to go giant size. And I think DC has something like a Devil's Island. I know they've got a Monster Island equivalent, where it's like the land that time forgot. They probably have one where, again, you've got the giant insects and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's as if you shrunk down, but you're normal size.
Yeah.
There were aspects that I could tell where they were pulling aspects from the comics. Aquaman's stealth suit. There was a period in the 80s where he ditched the regular outfit and had one that was multiple shades of blue with kind of different bands flowing or whatever around. They didn't move, but it was underwater camouflage, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And they took that and made it kind of a digital invisibility suit that somehow even worked on parts that weren't covered by the suit.
Yeah.
Which was a little weird. And they did a decent job with the story. It kept my attention throughout. Mm-hmm. There were a few parts that were almost stereotypical buddy cop comedy. And there were a couple of times where Black Manta was doing things that were a little inexplicable. When he's talking to the guy possessing him and doesn't shut the door.
Yep.
But there happens to be a button right in front of him by his mirror to do that. And you think, well, that's weird. And then there's another time where he doesn't even touch anything and the door closes.
Yeah.
Randall Park's character,
Dr. Shin,
was interesting but didn't end where I thought it would.
I would fully agree with that.
I totally expected him to be an ambassador to Atlantis at the end of the film.
I think he should have been. I think he actually was one of the more interesting characters that they brought into the movie that I don't remember from a previous movie.
I don't remember him from a previous DC movie. He's been in some stuff on the Marvel side. He was in WandaVision as one of the guys keeping an eye on the city. He plays James Wu in that universe. I don't remember if he was in the first Aquaman film or not, but having him as the wanting to research Atlantis, somebody who's funding him, that guy's essentially gone nuts, wants to kill the world. He can't get out.
Yeah.
And therefore is in a position to help the heroes in a few places.
Mm-hmm.
I liked that. I thought that was a good approach to take for the character, but it seemed almost telegraphed to me because of his genuine interest in Atlantis. He flat out tells Aquaman at one point he just wants to share Atlantis with the world.
Yep.
That when we get a, we need an ambassador at the end, and we cut to this guy, and he's just out in Times Square watching like everybody else.
Yeah.
Like, how did he get there? What's going on? That felt like a drop ball. It was unsatisfying. Yeah.
Especially since at the end of the battle, he was there with our heroes.
And had earned his keep. He helped save Arthur Jr.
And not in a accidental way, but in a fairly well premeditated way.
Yes. Yes. It wasn't just he was there and had the opportunity. He went out of his way to make sure, try to make sure the kid was safe.
Yeah.
So I appreciated that and didn't think he got the reward he was due. So, given how much this tied into events of the first movie, the little recap we got at the beginning with basically, the first movie happened, and here's what happened in between, and now let's get going, was insufficient for me.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Though I will say some of the early scenes where they're kind of introducing Aquaman as dad busted me up.
It was funny, but it also, I felt, undercut the seriousness, not the seriousness of the movie, but the believability of the character.
Yes.
He's an overgrown child is what it comes down to.
Yes. Who doesn't want to do the adulting of being king?
I don't blame him. But we also early on set up Arthur Jr.'s having the telepathic talk to fish ability.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think that was ever really paid off. Other than when he summoned his father.
And that's the thing. I think they feel they paid it off by having him summon his father, who frankly is not a fish.
Yeah.
If he had reached out to Topo, and Topo had basically whacked Dad in the direction of Junior.
If there had been a line of, we've got to find Arthur, and then suddenly all the fish are pointing, triangulating to a particular spot, and then go back to what they're doing.
That would have been priceless. Yes.
I mean, there's ways they could have made that work.
Yeah.
So, I liked it. I didn't love it. There was nothing I particularly hated about it. There were places I felt it was a little cliche, and not repetitive, but it goes to your comment on the different fight arenas, if you will, had the bridge, the towering thing, etc.
I was waiting for the brothers to comment that even the buried prison in the desert seemed to have the same architectural style as the Atlantean kingdoms.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of the, are you sure these aren't distant cousins?
And it would have made a lot of sense for Arthur to ask Orm about this. You know all about Atlantis and stuff. I'm still kind of new to this. What is it with the this, that, and the other? And it would have fit the style of the movie.
Yes. Yeah.
I think the first movie was better, but it also had, I'll say, the saving grace, but the advantage of a fairly blank slate to be started with.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this, we've got the baggage of the first film. Whether we, the audience, remember it or not, they certainly were trying to leverage it.
It felt like Momoa spent a pretty good portion of the movie in the Aquaman costume.
Mm-hmm.
And then it seemed at one point that the color of the top half of the costume changed.
It seemed like at the end of the main fight at the end.
Yeah.
It went from a
yellowy gold.
A yellowy gold to an almost orange red.
Yeah.
I was puzzled by that, too. I appreciated that they made it look like armor and...
And scaled armor.
Scaled armor. And it was a good rendition of the comic book suit.
I liked the look of it for the most part. I thought the gloves looked bigger and thicker than I thought they should.
Well, particularly when they're shaking hands at the end and the two grasp arms and there's a very loud clank.
Yeah.
It's like, I get armor is advantageous, but in the comics, part of what makes Atlanteans so tough is they're raised underwater in the crushing depths of the ocean and are naturally strong and dense.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't get, you know, crushed by the ocean pressure.
Yeah, yeah.
They are their own armor, so you don't really need that in terms of clanking metal armor. They did good use of the various tridents.
Mm-hmm.
Although there was one at the end, I'm like, wait, whose was that?
Yeah, but with the black trident, I actually liked the number of times Orm ended up holding it. And the reason I liked it was because the first time, and I said out loud, uh-oh.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is the guy who, frankly, seems easy to tempt by evil.
He was corruptible. Absolutely and understandably so. The part that got me was when he had it at the end, the evil guy had basically possessed him.
Mm-hmm.
And needed the blood of the Atlantean royal line to free himself. He basically takes Arthur, bangs him up against the pedestal so he bleeds into it, and boom, we're done. I'm like, but he's got his own blood.
Yeah.
He doesn't even need to fight Aquaman at that point.
But it's like some aspect of the being that possessed him didn't seem to realize they were brothers. You hate him more than the other one did.
So he knows all the backstory and doesn't know the relationship?
Yeah, it was weird.
I would have had him know that, have Aquaman, and it's like, well, I guess we got to fight now. Punch his brother, give him a bloody nose or something. Because the guy's not going to fight back. Great, you've got the blood flowing. Let me use it. You know, kind of, oh, crap moment.
Yes.
Aquaman.
And that would fit with Aquaman's using the muscles, punching first, falling asleep during the diplomatic meetings.
Punch first, think later.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think there was a better movie to be had. Not that this was a bad movie.
Yeah.
But saying it's a good DC movie is kind of faint praise.
Yeah, it's a low bar.
So many of them are just, they may be entertaining, but they're not good.
Mm-hmm.
And I've worked in one office environment where people would always get excited by the Marvel movies and consider going begrudgingly almost to a DC one, thinking, yeah, I'm curious, but with low expectations.
Well, here, some of the fight scenes were long enough and to a degree felt dragged out enough that I started noticing the environment and the, hey, I like the colors they're doing here. Mm-hmm. I like the way they've designed the city. But if my mind is wandering away from the fight and the action.
It's funny you say that because it makes me think this is a Jackie Chan film in some of the good ways and in some of the bad ways. Because a Jackie Chan film has enough of a plot to string together the action sequences, typically, which this very much felt like. We got to go here to do this, there to do this, fight this, do this, whatever. So it follows that basic pattern. But with the Jackie Chan movies, at least for me, typically, once the fight starts, you're glued to it because it's like, this guy just keeps moving. Often they're in long, continuous shots.
In gravity-defying ways.
Yes. Well, there's one or two where he is fighting somebody. You know how they'll like have the bow staff and they'll be doing the twists, the turns and stuff? Like, well, like they were doing the tridents here.
And that actually annoyed me.
But Jackie Chan would do it with like a 10-foot metal ladder.
Yeah.
And it's like, I gotta watch this. Here, the fight sequences, while they had moments, didn't have that level of choreography, that level of, okay, I'm engrossed in this sequence.
But to me, it felt like they were using a trident in an unnatural way, or a way that didn't fit the type of weapon. A trident didn't strike me as a weapon that you would use like a staff with nothing on either end. To me, it would be like using one of those dual-ended lightsabers only as a staff, and not taking advantage of the fact that it's got a lightsaber on each end.
And there were a couple of times he would throw the trident.
Yes.
And there was one that he was throwing it, and I'm like, don't do that. That's a bad, here's what's going to happen. And sure enough, that's what happened.
Yeah.
But followed up with another trident throw that was almost a Robin Hood moment.
Yes, and really the moment that led up to that, getting Trident in hand and throwing it, was a powerful heartstring moment.
Yes, yes. They did a few things with he had lost the Trident and how he gets it back.
Yeah.
So I didn't mind the Trident being used essentially as a battle staff or whatever. I agree, when you've got the prongs at the one end, maybe you should leverage that or should help or something. And usually it didn't. I mean, how we've seen that in other cases is they'll catch the other Trident in the prongs and kind of twist it or whatever, which never seemed to happen here.
I don't think we used a single net in the fights.
No, I don't think there was a single net in the film.
Which to me, I mean, just fishing nets, nets in general.
I think we had some of that in the first film.
Yeah. Going back to it, felt to me very much like land-based fighting.
It felt very much like a land-based film with a few places I had lost track. Are we still underwater at this point?
Yes.
And I took that as the underwater aspects were digitally underwater. And from a writing, directing point of view, they were treating it as if it's on land the entire time, and they weren't thinking underwater.
Yeah.
Because I think if it had been underwater, and there were some that were definitely above the water, but if it had been underwater, there were places to do kind of a more three-dimensional fight versus just we're at ground level, we're knocking tridents against each other, let's go jump, bounce against the wall and try it again.
Yeah.
Which isn't a bad thing, but I think it had the opportunity for a more creative fight choreographer to really make this seem like the way Atlanteans fight feels like it was developed underwater, feels like it makes sense both underwater and on land.
When we had one of the land-based people fighting underwater with an Atlantean, it's Manta, he uses, it's not heat vision, whatever it is.
Well, his ray blast or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, and it throws the Atlantean or pins them against a building. Instead of thrusting them against a building, I wish the person had been thrust against what looked like a tree, because a land-based person would expect them to hit the tree and get caught, whereas underwater, all of that foliage seemed to just kind of flow away as beings swam between it and through it. And I wanted something like that to catch the land-based person off guard. Of, wait, I'm fighting in a different environment. I have to change my style and my tactics.
What I would have liked to have seen, particularly if they'd gone for a more Tai Chi approach to Atlantean fighting, is have a surface person fighting an Atlantean underwater and starting to get the hang of, okay, I see where their moves are, I can start to dodge.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, do okay. But then there's a rematch on land. And they're thinking, ah, now they're in my element.
Mm-hmm.
Forgetting, air has much less resistance than water, and suddenly the Atlantean seems to be moving five times faster.
Mm-hmm. And hitting harder.
And hitting harder.
Yeah. I will say the scene I loved for creativity was when we were in the ship graveyard.
Mm-hmm.
And Aquaman needs to get answers from the guy in charge of it.
He almost reverse drowns him.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty good. I guess that was the one that Martin Short did the voice for?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, we get to this underwater place that's built out of sunken ships, etc. First stop, the cantina out of Star Wars. Second stop, Jabba's place.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there were a few places that felt a little creatively bankrupt, or derivative at the very least. And again, not bad, but not original, not groundbreaking, not impressive. And I don't expect every film to be charting new ground.
No, but there are some things that seem to have become numbers that movies like this feel they need to paint, like the cantina scene.
It's the checklist we've got to go through. How many films have we seen where there's the equivalent of, and it's not just here's the saloon in the Old West town, it's literally, this is the cantina in Star Wars with the musical number going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's a lot of tropes and cliches. The fact that the underwater mobster looked so much like Jabba, big fat green thing.
Yeah.
It was disappointing, and I know they can do better.
Yeah.
They just seem to get a little either late. I mean, they can't not know what they're referencing.
Yeah, exactly.
It's one thing of, oh, well, there was this obscure movie in the middle of the 80s that I think it's just like, no, Star Wars.
Well, but that is the thing. Star Wars got away with referencing John Carter of Mars.
because it was effectively unknown to the audience.
Yeah.
Yeah. And by the time the John Carter movie came out, everyone's like, we've seen this before. Yes, but this is the property that did it first, not in the movie, of course, but where they got all the tropes from.
Yeah.
Which is just kind of funny in and of itself. And it's where the tail sometimes wags the dog of when you take a comic, turn it into films, and then some of those film things start feeding back to the comics. And then they start using comic stories from after some of these films had been produced.
Yeah.
There were aspects of this Aquaman film that were in direct reference to Aquaman having been seen as a joke. And I'm pretty sure there were lines of captions to this effect in the New 52 run of Aquaman that are referential of everything from the Saturday Night Live skit with Aquaman of, oh, he talks to fish and stuff from the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So how these characters get into the mainstream culture, how the mainstream culture views them, and then the reaction to that in the comics and how it, again, bounces back into the movies and stuff sometimes is interesting. Sometimes it's just a little annoying, too.
Yeah.
So could they have done a third movie if they hadn't changed regimes at DC? It's Momoa. They probably would have tried.
Yeah.
But they've basically scuttled this universe in favor of the new one with the Superman film, etc. So we'll see if and when we get a new version of Aquaman there.
Mm-hmm.
Again, Momoa is going to be in the Supergirl movie as Lobo, which I've seen the trailer for. I've got mixed feelings on. DC has done some good films, but they're few and far between. I think they've had more success on television. Marvel's had more success on films, less on TV.
I think that's, yeah, a fair assessment.
And it was kind of funny to me at the credits how many people in this film had been in Marvel films.
Mm.
Dolph Lundgren had been Punisher. Randall Park had been Jimmy Woo. But there's so many films out there from both franchises, it's hard to not have people who've worked in one or the other. But then also the army of people that worked on this film with all the digital effects, all of the regular filmmaking as well.
Yeah.
I am very curious how many people were listed in the credits and how that compares to some of the, frankly, the lower selling Aquaman titles. Mm. I mean, there was one, Aquaman and the Others, because he was part of a team called the Others, because I guess they were out of other names, that I want to say was selling under 10,000 units at the end. It didn't last long. It was a second Aquaman title that I can barely hold one. And again, Aquaman and the Others, not a compelling title.
Yeah.
Literally. And this had to have way more people involved in the making of this film than I think would frequently buy an Aquaman title these days.
Probably.
So, glad we saw it.
Me too.
Not upset that we waited to see it.
No, I'll agree with that too.
I enjoyed it enough.
I did like Nicole Kidman.
Yeah.
As a mom.
Mm-hmm.
Boba Fett as dad.
Yeah, yeah.
Temuera Morrison.
Yeah, he's a good actor. We've seen him in a couple of things.
Mm-hmm.
He was in episode or two of My Life is Murder.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So, talented guy. John Rhys Davies as the Crab King.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be honest, Martin Short, until we saw the credits, I didn't realize he had done the voice.
Neither did I.
And even after seeing the credits, it was like, wait, which one was he again? But yeah. Which is good, because if it had been a cliche Martin Short as Martin Short,
it would have distracted me.
It would have distracted. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they had a good cast overall.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else?
I think that does it.
Cool. Thanks for listening to this episode. If you liked this episode, please spread the word about the Comic Book Page podcast by telling your friends and posting a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And please, join our Slack community and let us know what you thought of this episode. I do this podcast because I enjoy talking about comics. So let's talk about comics. The show notes, forum, and instructions for how to join our Slack channel can be found at www.comicbookpage.com. The opinions of the co-hosts and guests are their own. The Comic Book Page podcast is copyright John Mayall. And thanks again for listening.